this is Kirk Jackson. He is the security architect at Xero.
And this is Andy Proud. He's the managing director of Aura InfoSec, which is a security testing and penetration testing company.
That's the one. Security testing, penetration testing, secure developer training.
Cool.
Now you come to us. Thank you. It's Xero. I believe you do online accounting.
That's right.
Hey, not bad, you see. So very good. So the reason that we put our funny-faced friend up there before is when we're talking about HackEd and security and secure webs and people getting attacked, there's two things that always come to mind. Just like a normal crime, motive versus opportunity. Now what we see from the motive side of life, motive is, I don't care what defenses you've got in place, I don't care what time I'm going to take, I have a motive to try and attack your system for some reason, for financial gain, for political hacktivism.
And opportunity is more like the guy just wandering along and happens to notice your servers sitting there with Telnet open or SSH open. Just something that you've got that they stumble across. Maybe they've got something crawling the internet looking for it. So today's talk, we're really going to be sharing some stories. So some feedback we got last year was that people wanted to hear real stories about real New Zealand companies. And so we've taken some of Aura's customers and got their permission, the
Correct.
Ones that we can talk about,
Correct.
To talk about what happened to them and how they dealt with it, and also some other stories from around the world that kind of sum up the last 12 months in security. And so that's what we're going to talk about today, I think. Yeah.
Well, I hope so. That's what I'm talking about. What are you talking about?
Yep, that's good.
That's good. Okay, cool. So the first area of attack that we're going to look at is the good old classic denial of service, right? So there's actually been a lot of people that we've seen this year where denial of service is absolutely on the rise. And when we talk about denial of service, we had DOS, denial of service. We had DDoS, distributed denial of service. Now it's kind of turning into more of the three DOS, the diverse distributed denial of service. But if we take a step back, so DOS. So remember here, we're not referring to a, 1980s disk operating system, DR-DOS versus MS-DOS. DOS can be a far more...
DOS 3.3 was the best.
You reckon?
DOS 4 was shit.
Yeah. Yep. So there we go. So if anyone's noting down takeaways or particular tweets,
yep.
DOS 3.3.
Yep. I think they still sell it.
Do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's part of the MSDN subscription. Right. Now denial of service, though, it needs to be quite careful. It can be a very personal effect as well. So as an example, I forgot our anniversary last year in October, and so it was about a 3-week denial of service. So so you've got to be very careful. So
what we're really talking about is a proper denial of service. So the attacker is trying to take you out of action. So one way this can happen is just by flooding your network so that your web servers or whatever behind that pipe don't have enough bandwidth to handle legitimate requests. And so a common one used for this is LOIC, which is the Low Orbit Ion Cannon, which I think some anonymous people have used and perhaps even been arrested for using.
The Low Orbit Ion Cannon. That's a cool name, mate.
Yeah, so, and that basically just...
do a similar.
It just basically sprays crap at your network. And the way it works is there's thousands of these anonymous people sitting on IRC, people identifying themselves with the meme Anonymous. They don't actually have an official organization. But they're sitting on the end of IRC, they get given a target, and everyone from their own computers just attacks it. There's also the botnet-style attacks. So this is where... millions of your parents' computers, grandma's computers, all around the world that have been virused and trojaned up to the max are sending out probably malicious spam, probably spam and phishing emails, but also can be used to denial of service your site and your server farm.
And so I guess one of the trends that we've actually seen growing more is more attacks against layer 7, the application layer. And so also in this distributed and diverse denial of service. So for instance, there's been attacks this year, things like, well, not just this year, but SlowLoris. For example, what that is that sort of makes an attack that makes a request of your website, but it makes a very slow request. In other words, it consumes the responses really slowly, down to as small as 1 byte every 110 seconds of one of the recorded stats. So what that means is that you get a nice GET request on your website starts responding, but the thing at the other end is really slow. It's like, wait, slower. And then the attackers actually create hundreds of thousands of these requests all in one go. So your website's sitting there perfectly happy, just really slowly giving data down to the people requesting it the air. And it just thinks it's got a whole bunch of, you know, Windows 95 boxes like a lot of our government agency friends.
Yeah, and most web servers have a limit of, you can configure IIS to have a limit of, say, 1,000 requests simultaneously, and one guy can take them up with something like Slow Loris. And that's been around for ages. That was
us. It has. But funnily enough, it's actually becoming more prevalent now. Yeah. And also Slow Post. So a Slow Post is the other way around, where, again, data is being posted back. So you've got a big rich .NET website. Maybe it's a couple of 100K to a couple of 100 meg, depending on how well you've written your code. And when the data is getting posted back, similar deal, it just trickle
feeds. View state, a couple of 100
If you turn on view state, then it's at least a couple of 100 meg. So again, it just trickle feeds the response to your server. So it's really just consuming it. And we've also seen attacks where, say, if you've got a slow search page, that might be used as part of the attack profile to run a number of concurrent searches, actually just consuming resources. So that's kind of the profile of them. But coming back to the denial of service and the consuming of resources. So here's the ironic thing we've actually seen a few customers hit with this year. We've had a few clients with very large scalable systems, maybe their Azure or one of the other cloud services. They can dynamically scale network, disk, CPU, RAM. Now what they've actually managed to do is they've been under some fairly large denial of service attacks that have been going for a couple of days. And what they've actually done is they've survived the attack really well, but it's cost them a bloody fortune in all of the increased CPU, RAM, and network traffic that they've actually scaled to. So we've actually got what we're seeing, more of that denial of business. We're actually getting clients coming back and going, you know what, it would have been really cheaper if we hadn't have survived that attack, because it's just cost us 40 grand, 100 grand in extra usage to sustain the attack. Whereas it may have cost the attacker, you can actually like rent botnets for, you know, hundreds of dollars an hour.
$100 an hour, yeah.
Exactly. So it's far cheaper to attack than it is to defend. So it's kind of a weird one, just to bear in mind. So one of the clients that we can speak about, so Mr. Craig Smith, the CEO of Language Perfect, is more than happy for languageperfect.com to be talked about. So I don't know, anyone here got sort of kids, teenage kids at school doing languages in CEA? Yep. Wow, just a few. So
we're all young folk here.
Yeah, good point. So Language Perfect, right? So it's a they exist online. That's the only way that Language Perfect can be accessed. They are just an NCEA schools learning site and accessed by students across Australia and New Zealand. And you just log into Language Perfect and you ask the questions in Spanish, French, whatever else it may be. So they, between the 21st and 31st of May this year, were running their World Championship. Coming back to the motive, one would have to think, why? You know, maybe it's an angry NCA level 2 guy who's just failing his Spanish. But for whatever reason, just after the competition was launched, they had a sustained, distributed, diverse denial of service attack. So what actually happens? It was an international distributed denial of service. Traffic was coming from multiple locations around the globe. Lasted for 4 days. It attacked everything from layer 4 to layer 7. Now, if I was to say, for instance, it did a whole bunch of SYN floods. Now, what I'd expect is in this day and age with you kids out there in the audience, a lot of people these days actually don't understand some of this layer 4 TCP stuff. So just so you understand SYN flood, actually, just a quick one. Who actually understands the SYNAC TCP handshake? Not bad. Okay, for all those who don't. So a SYNAC TCP handshake, so basically I'm a client, you're a server.
G'day.
So we come up and it's basically, hi.
Hi.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
So that's basically a SYNAC TCP handshake. Except on the quiet, what also happens is that what I'd actually do is I'd say, synchronous, I want to talk to you. And you would go,
SYNAC?
Yeah, baby. And I'd go, ack. So basically when they designed it, they were after like a much sort of shorter sort of handshake. So it's a really short handshake. So what happens is that what we call a SYN flood is when I'll go, hey, SYN, I want to talk to you.
I think our handshake was better.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Okay.
It's when I go, sorry, hi.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, okay.
Okay. We're not going to do that again.
We can do
it. Later.
Okay.
In a hotel room.
Oh, no, that. Are you bringing the girls?
You just took it one step too far.
No, I didn't.
No, is that?
Okay. SYNAC, TCP, handshake.
Okay, yeah, so SYN floods.
So for this particular SYN flood, so what actually happens, so Language Perfect is under attack, 4 days. They received 200 billion rogue SYN flood attacks and network layer attacks in a 4-day period of time. It was actually one of the admins at Language Perfect said, oh man, can you actually send us like a copy of the logs, just like, I don't know, copy and paste into Excel or something? Like, yeah, sure. So we actually tried that, but seriously, 200 billion into Excel. Just, it almost worked. It was just the font was the wrong size.
Excel 2014 will do it.
It would, because it just said, look, is this formatted text? Is this HTML? And I think that's what kind of blew it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what actually happens? So anyway, so the site comes under attack and it dies instantly. So they've got up to like 1.5 million connections are coming in per second. So the site lasts about 1 second until it actually just dies from a network layer attack. So this is when we were called in. So yes, we managed to get the site up and running within hours and managed to keep it running through the whole attack. But what was interesting is that it very quickly, when the network layer started surviving, they absolutely went straight to start attacking the application layer. So the application, they started coming in from hundreds of thousands of addresses. They were using security scanning tools. They were trying to do password brute forcing. We could see SQL injection attacks coming through, cross-site scripting. There was defacement attempts. They were actually crawling the site looking for admin pages, different, you know, random PHP, .NET, web config files that might have been on the server. So it was an absolute spray attack. So
this probably would have been quite stressful for the language perfect guys, eh? So, I mean, I wouldn't have...
Yeah.
Probably if I was working there, I wouldn't have expected this to happen. But it was a big week for them. They were just launching the competition, hundreds of thousands of students. And they're completely flooded within seconds.
Absolutely. So
what was going through their heads as this was happening?
Well, that's just it. I guess if you look at that, coming back to that human factor again, is that, so Craig Smith, the MD, he's running this competition, and both his site is off the internet full stop. It's just not running. He's got kids at school with nothing that they can do. So from this perspective, he would do anything to get the site back up. And again, his team and his devs had no technical knowledge about how you would respond to this kind of attack.
Oh, and someone who'll do anything to recover from an attack is perfect for a security consultant.
Sorry.
No, sure, dear man.
Okay, keep to the script. Okay. Yeah, keep to the script, dude. So what was interesting, so I guess, so with regards to how it was brought up, so I guess if anyone's interested in DDoS and denial of service mitigation, then that's actually another story from another trench for another day, because it kind of gets a bit hardcore and techo. But probably the key thing, and the only reason that I have permission from Craig to actually say that the site did come under this kind of attack, and I guess the message we want to put across, of course, is often we talk to people about, you know, what sort of defenses have you got, you know, are you worried about these sorts of things? Lots of people are like, yeah. Why are Anonymous going to have a look at us? Again, coming back to our friendly face at the beginning, well, that was because Mega Upload was taken down, and so Anonymous started targeting some US and New Zealand organizations. So for this one, why would you target Language Perfect? Who knows, but it happens, right? So one of the key things that the reason we have permission to talk about them is that the competition for 10 days was one of the world's most successful online educational events. They did have students answering over 10 million questions over that period of time.
100 million questions.
100 million questions.
Just keeping to the script.
Oh, very good. Cool. And Peter Garrett from the Australian Ministry of Education said what a wonderful event it was. So it was actually a complete success. Well, I guess the key thing to note here is that to begin with, it was not a complete success and it was highly stressful. And we're seeing more of this denial of service attack just taking systems out, and particularly at the application layer. So do we learn anything from this, Mr. Kirk?
Well, obviously your application shouldn't have bugs, but we've talked about that before in other talks. But there's other things like patching your operating system, patching your services. They will help you. Like, I mean, if you've got an application that's got some slow bits, then once you stop those network attacks like they did after the first few days, and you start getting attacked at your application level, then those slow bits are going to be the ones that you pick. Like possibly 10 years ago, possibly a little bit more, in Java I built a web app that performed absolutely horribly under search when you were using the search page on it. And the first time we got crawled by a web crawler bot, the server blew up. So pages like that you need to make as fast as possible because people will target them. And I guess the other thing about those sort of functions are is if you know you're under attack, think about how you can gracefully degrade the functions of your site. So how do you switch off the hard bits that your server has trouble with and still keep, you know, the stuff that earns you money mostly running? The other thing is, as people, like we're saying, typically don't defend against these attacks until they actually happen. And often the story afterwards is not something we can talk about because it doesn't go well. But luckily for Language Perfect, it did. But what sort of investment are you actually looking at to do this kind of protection? So I don't actually sell any of this stuff. I sell accounting software. Actually, I don't even sell accounting software. I don't even write accounting software. I don't know exactly what I do, but Andy's kind of involved in WAF sales in the periphery, so we'll try not to make this a sales pitch. But the idea is, I'll do the talking.
Okay,
and you can correct all my mistakes.
That's fine.
So the idea is you put one of these WAF devices in front of your website and all the traffic goes through it. And it'll stop some basic level of attacks. So some really obvious kind of stuff. I mean, it's not the smart devices, but they can't catch targeted application-specific stuff like hitting your search page over and over. And then once you have an issue, then you write a rule specific for that issue, and you can do that really fast because you've already got the network infrastructure there. So I guess getting one of those devices inserted into your environment, I don't know how much they cost.
$6 quillion.
Yep. So
set up.
Yeah. So probably somewhere around the order of $10,000 or 20, something.
Yeah. Exactly.
And also you've got the IPS devices, which stands for intrusion prevention somethings.
Correct.
Cool.
And exactly what it stands for.
And that's more of a network layer. So whereas WAF's more of a web application layer, the IPS is a more of a network kind of thing. So you could say reject any SYN-ACK conversations that last longer than this amount of time before getting a reply. Because the thing that's hard about these distributed attacks is you can't just say, block this guy in Russia, because it's hundreds, thousands of people all around the world. Sometimes people go into defensive mode and they cut off everyone except New Zealand, which is probably not too an unreasonable thing to do. You should probably talk to your ISP provider type people about whether you could do that if things went really bad.
Well, I think the point you got there about, so just finish this point, one of the key things you absolutely want to do is do some kind of dry run, some kind of planning for this. What you do not want to be doing is when you're under attack, then trying to work out from your hosting provider who they get their traffic from, who they get there from, and try and work out what you're going to do. In this scenario, when Language Perfect were at the peak of attack, their hosting provider actually asked them to go away because they were disrupting all traffic on all of their systems. And at that time, there was a bit of an emergency call. We were part of the people calling around, and we were calling around New Zealand hosting providers going, by the way, we've got this crowd that's under a massive international denial of service attack, but their current hosting provider wants to kick them out. Do you want to take them on as a client?
Not a very strong bargaining position, is it?
Please.
So, most of the people that we host our servers with, they don't actually own the internet. So there's a few steps between them and Al Gore. And so you really want to make sure you know all the people on the way up and know whether your contract actually even protects you in these situations. I'm guessing that most of us, our contracts don't have any protection. The other thing that sucks in New Zealand is that we pay for traffic, and we pay a lot of for traffic. And if the malicious traffic is getting all the way to your firewall or WAF, and then you're dropping it, you're probably paying for it to come from your ISP to you, whereas the best blocks are probably further up the chain. But my understanding is that people like Telecom, they really won't do this for you unless you're big. So good to have that conversation. See how you go. And that fire drill is really important. So, when this sort of thing happens, you're in the machine room plugging and unplugging cables, whatever IT ops people do. We don't normally do that. And the CEO is calling you and the CFO is calling you and this is happening. Like, how do you actually handle that kind of incident response? Is it the case that Andy does all the technical stuff and I just answer the phone for the next 2 hours? Probably not a good idea. Probably better the other way around. Actually have a plan for what actually happens, what happens if it happens on a Friday night at 5 o'clock when you're drunk, that sort of thing.
In fact, there was a survey that was done on some CEOs around New Zealand. And what was interesting, when CEOs were asked, you're currently getting a hack, your site's down, the world is falling. So who was the first person you would call? Nearly all of them, I think it was about a 70% response said that they would call a PR company first. So that's the CEO's response, let's call the PR company and let's make sure the press is going to be really good. Second is like, oh, I guess someone should also look at technically what's going on in the system. So again.
By the time the CEO finds out, it's all finished anyway.
So that
kind of leads into, I guess, something that was kind of hot topic for us in the .NET space this year, which was this kind of framework or application level issues. So we're responsible for building our own code and putting it on our servers, and we kind of trust everything else that requires to work. So we trust the operating system, we trust our firewalls, we trust ASP.NET, we trust security companies to do that. Who else do we trust? Antivirus. So we trust a lot of these ancillary things to all just work fine, but occasionally they don't. And so it was on, when was it, December 29th or something like that? So I think it was a little bit earlier. There was an announcement that this guy was going to present at a security conference just after Christmas last year. And he was going to talk about this hash DOS attack against a lot of popular programming stacks like PHP and .NET, ASP.NET. And Microsoft, they built their release patch. I think the build date was the 25th of December, so someone had a shitty Christmas.
Exactly.
And they released it on the 29th. And so instantly everyone has to patch their servers on the 29th of December. I can't remember, maybe it was the 30th in New Zealand. I can't remember the exact date, but I remember I was on holiday and it was annoying. And so how do we deal with this? First, I thought I could do a quick what was the attack for the people who like stuff like that. So this is a picture of a hash table or a dictionary in .NET terminology. And if you've done CompSci, you've probably seen this. The idea of a dictionary or a hash table is to make it really fast to look up data. So rather than have to search through a whole list of information, you can go from the key, which in this case is a person's name, straight to the piece of data. So if my key is John, say Lisa Smith, I use a hash function which returns the number one, and I go straight to bucket one and my data's there. So that's order one lookup, very, very fast. And if things are going bad, you might get two things going to the same bucket, like John Smith and Sandra D. They both have the hash value of 152, and they both go to that same bucket. And so when you're searching for this information, you might have to search through two items to find it, so you might end up with slightly slower performance. But the really bad case happens when you end up with a lot of items all under the same bucket. So here's another badly photographed picture of a hash table. This one has four items all under the hash position 2. And you can see the items are all quite similar. And it turns out that in a lot of programming environments, the algorithm is predictable. So what these attackers did is they made this 4 megabyte file, which is basically a bunch of different post parameters, so they're all about nine characters or so. The key, all hashes to the same value in the hash table, and the value is empty. So 4 megabytes, so it's probably, I don't know, a million post variables or something like that, and posted at any ASP.NET server. And that consumes 650 minutes of CPU time on any ASP.NET website.
So this that's 1 4-meg post.
1 4-megabyte post.
650 minutes of CPU time.
So if you've got 4 cores on your server, someone just needs to submit 4 4-megabyte files, and then your server stops working. This is kind of a big deal. This is why releasing at Christmas was a real pain in the ass, but why Microsoft hurried to do it as fast as they could. And so someone with a gigabyte a second of traffic can keep 30,000 Core 2 Duos busy. Cores. So gigabit Ethernet, I mean, you can even get that in New Zealand now, so this is a big issue. And what was happening then is that it basically degraded to worst case performance for a hash table. So the first thing ASP.NET does when it receives any request is it does some kind of enumeration over all the items that have been posted, and that was giving N squared performance. So as they posted more items, it got slower and slower and slower. And it wasn't actually really Microsoft's fault. I mean, this is just a known behavior for hash tables or dictionaries. I mean, they're designed like that. I guess the issue was that someone went, hey, this is a really good way to chew up CPU, and there's no protection to stop that CPU chewing up. So they released that patch. The patch, I could ask how many people have installed the patch. Don't put your hands up because someone might find out you didn't install the patch. The patch came out on the 29th of December. You can't tell if you've installed it. And I found that on some boxes, I'd run Windows Update and it wouldn't install, and it was really annoying. The only way you could really test it was to try and submit 1,000 parameters and see what happened to the CPU. Or how it actually worked is it blocked any request that had 1,000 or more parameters in it. So you could actually submit a benign request with 1,000 parameters and see if it got blocked.
So is this why we couldn't do our accounts at the end of December?
No, that's not why.
Production testing.
No, we were fine. We didn't have this issue at all. Said with a straight face, we didn't. Now, what we did have, which was really interesting, was we had our customers tweet us and asked us if we'd installed the patch, which is the first time since I've been at Xero that our customers have proactively checked that we have installed Windows Update patches, which is kind of cool to see. So that was good. So the protection restricted it to 1,000 parameters. There's no way of testing if you've got it installed. And .NET 4.5, which I believe has just been released or something, apparently there's a conference you can go to hear all about it, that's actually put some protection in ASP.NET again. So now you can have more than 1,000 parameters posted again, which is good. But every website that starts up on your server has a slightly different hash algorithm now, so there's a bit of randomness in there. So it's not possible for an attacker to predict which blob of 4 megabytes will cause your CPU to spike. They've also put some other features in that are kind of similar. So another issue was this regular expression denial of service attack. So you know you might have an email address validation control in your page with a regular expression at the back end, and ASP.NET web forms will handily put the regular expression on the front end so that JavaScript can run it for you. Regular expressions are normally kind of fast, they're normally okay, but there's kind of this bad case scenario where if you've got backtracking in your regular expression and it's complex enough, you can send the CPU into 100% spin with certain input, and since you've just told the attackers what your regular expressions are, they can predict it. It's pretty simple. Basically, you want to get something that requires a maximum amount of backtracking, so the regex engine just keeps going like this all the time with the input. And so they put a protection in that as well. So you can say, I've got this regular expression on my website. It's allowed to run for a maximum of 30 seconds, 1 second, half a second, or whatever seems like a reasonable amount of time. Just to wrap that up as well, there's a guy called Troy Hunt, who's a dev security MVP from Australia. He's got this site called A Safer Web. So it's actually easier if you go to troyhunt.com. And you can plug your URL in, and it'll test to see if you've got the HashDOS patch installed. And it just does it by sort of heuristics, because it's actually not possible to tell if you've got patches installed on your server remotely. But yeah, good site. So what do we get out of that? Well, I guess what we got out of that is that something that you don't do can still kill your server. It's kind of application specific in that, you know, your regular expression or your dictionary use is your application, but also you're trusting all this framework of stuff. And it turns out there's nothing to protect you from that. Like, IIS is built to run high CPU tasks, because who knows, maybe someone will want a web page that generates Excel spreadsheets by running Excel in the background, or something that uses lots of CPU. So IIS doesn't kill them automatically. So how do you detect this? How do you recover from it? How do you get that stuff into your environment? We're going to talk a little bit more about the sort of recovery from attacks in our architecture talk tomorrow.
Yes, correct.
How you do the sort of long-term life of your app. But, you know, when things are attacking your framework, you just have to patch it. That's basically your only thing you can do. So I advise you to think about, you know, what's going to happen if something gets disclosed at 5 o'clock on a Friday. Luckily in New Zealand, most of the patches come out on Tuesday or Wednesday New Zealand time or something. But, you know, who wakes up, who does the comms, who's covering it over Christmas when your sysadmin's away, all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Cool.
So we've done a bit of denial of servicey stuff, both at the app layer and, I guess, the network layer. Now, defacement is quite a key one that we've seen quite a lot of. And so people are familiar with a normal website defacement where it now looks funny, it does weird stuff. We've had examples here in New Zealand where the day before the general election last year, the Greenies went and defaced a couple of power company websites, those sorts of things.
Not the Green Party, just Green
Party. People, yeah. Perhaps, who are green in nature.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. And you don't want to libel anyone.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. That was kind of on. Yeah, no, good point. Rewind that one. Yeah. People.
So they defaced the site.
Defaced the site. And then started tweeting about it the day before the general election.
Yeah.
So it does go on. But look, one of the key things that we've seen more commonly is, in fact, a lot of the search defacements, where in fact your site still looks okay, but it's in fact your search engine results that are getting really dorked over through the attacks. So as an example here, this is some HTML taken from a, so it's not a New Zealand website. This website did have a .gov in its name, so it was a global government website somewhere. That's as far as we can go, but not New Zealand.
And I recommend not typing those URLs into your browser.
Well, you can do. I really don't know where they go.
No.
It's
probably you'll get viruses or something.
Yeah, quite true. So what this is, what this content is, this is some content that exists on a government website that is, you know, talking about various services that they offer, and here is this little hidden bunch of links that exists.
So it's inside a div style display is none, so it's hidden content. No one can see it when they browse this page, but search engines can see it.
Yeah, well, that's one of the key points as well, is that, so as a quick, wrong one.
We're rocking these two laptops.
Oh, man, dope. So again, as for example, the search results that would come through. So it's just one where it just had that little key Viagra at the end. Some of the other search results were just the full, you know, Viagra, Vardavard, Lady, yada, yada. Now, what was interesting is that, again, looking at the site, none of this came through. So again, what some of the attacks do is once they've compromised a website, that the content they're serving up is very specific to, say, for instance, am I being viewed by the Googlebot?
Yeah, so...
Or the Bingbot?
Oh, yes, Bingbot, yeah.
Yeah, good point.
Bing! Is it called the Bingbot?
I don't know, is it called the Bingbot? The Googlebot. Is the Bingbot the Bingbot?
Yeah, cool. It's a Bingbot.
Bingbot. Cool. So, again, but particularly what the attack code does, it looks, it says, look, am I being viewed by one of the crawlers, in which case I will serve up my Buy Viagra here, and I've got all my embedded links. If you're just viewing me normally, then I'll hide everything I can. So you look at the site, and you can't see that it's compromised, yet in the search results, there it is. And so they're honing up the Buy Viagra search results. But what they're also tend to do, therefore, is the companies that get attacked by this start slamming down their own search engine results, so because they start to get banned by the search engine. So they go, well, actually, you're also linking off to blacklisted websites, so I'm going to drop you from my search results. So you actually find clients who get infected by this, it really drops them off their own where they want to be in the search results, and it takes them a bloody long time to get back up again.
Yeah, Google Juice is worth a lot of money to these people for some reason.
Google Juice.
Google Juice, as is selling Panadol, pretending it's Viagra. Apparently it's worth a lot of money. So why do people do this? So they're probably just doing it for the laughs a lot of the time. So there's a lot of companies out there that are using content management systems on their websites that it's easy to tell what version it is. So often you can tell if someone's CMS is Embraco or WordPress or whatever just by guessing some URLs and seeing if they exist. And then you can find out which version it is by using one of these fingerprinting tools. So even if the site doesn't say I'm running XYZ version 1.2, you know, the CSS file in the admin directory is the same as the one that shipped with that version, so they can tell. In fact, there's a Wellington guy, I think, that's got one of those fingerprinting tools that'll do that. So they'll just be searching the internet, find some sites with CMSs that have non-loopholes, problems, issues, and just for a few laughs, they'll put some content on it. And so that's one way, definitely. So sort of legitimate content that's been typed in through the CMS front end. The other way is actual code on disk that's been altered, so ASP.NET pages where some ASP code has been inserted, or WordPress themes that have PHP code in them that says, you know, if user agent is Googlebot, display this.
Yep.
And someone did some analysis of WordPress themes that were freely available, and there's lots of those free theme sites, and they actually did have hidden links off to advertising in them.
Or even just some good cross-site scripting attack where instead of embedding script, we can embed iframes to our malicious content.
Yeah, so another big thing at the moment is this crimeware kind of framework thing. Crimeware. So, framework thing. I think that's what it's called.
So it's
like black hole.
So, correct. So, one of the biggest ones that was prevalent on the internet, I guess, this year, so the like AVG stats said that 91% of malware traffic delivered from compromised websites was through the black hole exploitation kit. So the black hole exploitation kit, the way that it works is you do need a web server that's got a vulnerability on it. So either I can upload my code to it, I can modify the files that are up there, or maybe it does have something like a cross-site scripting attack where I can inject my code, so maybe I can do a job ad or enter for a job with my name as Andy, open bracket, iframe, blah, 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 to my malicious content, prowl. So as soon as someone then views it. So the fact is that, so you've got a compromised website, I deliver my malicious iframe. When I then view that from a non-patched vulnerable browser, so again, it's a browser-based attack, but what happens is that the iframe links me off to a Black Hole Exploitation Kit server. It downloads then a rolling set of malicious content to my browser. So it will download attacks for IE, for Chrome, for Firefox. It'll then cycle through the PDF reader. It'll cycle through your Java, Silverlight. So all the plugins that you then have installed until hopefully one of them gets a trigger and actually runs a compromise and compromises your machine.
So it's actually pretty clever software. So,
very.
So on your website, all you have is an extra iframe. Somewhere else on the internet is the site hosting this black hole.
That's right.
And it looks at what the user's browser is. It looks at their version of Adobe Reader, and it sends them a specific exploit.
Yep.
So a PDF file inside an iframe, they'll never see it. The PDF triggers some PDF reader exploit, which installs a Trojan.
Yep.
The Trojan's on that person's computer. The next time that person goes to that website, Black Hole won't serve anything up to them because it's already seen them before. So it's quite smart and makes it quite hard to detect, because someone will email you and say, hey, your website detected malware when I was using AVG, if you're lucky. I think there's some bad stats about how often they're detected as well. AVG is probably as good as any of them. But and you'll go and look at it and you won't see anything. So it's quite hard to detect them. And once they've got that Trojan on your computer, on the end user's computer, then they can do anything on it. So a common thing is to enlist that computer in a botnet and get it to send spam. There's still apparently money in spam.
Apparently so.
And, you know, you don't have to pay for the computers or the power, so it's very cheap.
You also get, they'll install keyloggers. In fact, when you get one of these exploits running, first thing it'll do is hunt for antivirus and try and disable and turn it off. It'll actually hunt for other Trojans. So, like, the Black Hole Exploitation Kit will look for another Trojan platform, like Zeus as an example. So it'll hunt for the antivirus, try and turn it off. It'll hunt for other Trojans, try and remove them, installs keyloggers, and then opens up a command and control channel that says, what would you like me to do? It'll do file upload, file download, run processes. So it's a very, in essence, this is true click-buy malware. So you've gone to a website that you trust, but it has been compromised, and that's where the contents come down to your machine.
And what these guys do is they amass a collection of botnet bots that they control, and then they rent them out. So the guy that was doing the Language Perfect attack probably paid $50 to $100, although you wouldn't expect a school student to have that much money. But, you know, it's like a small amount of money.
Student loan.
Right.
So
you never have to pay those back.
Well, it's also interesting.
Yes,
you can actually go and buy like the Black Hole Exploitation Kit. So $1,500 US is the annual license fee. Again, it's not illegal to buy it in the same way it's not illegal to buy guns. It's illegal to use it, and it's what you do with it that's illegal. But for $1,500, you can buy the exploitation kit. It actually comes with regular updates. So as there are new exploits against various web servers and various technologies, then it actually runs with live updates. So it is truly commoditized exploitation. And I guess that's why we're seeing quite so much of it now. So crimeware.
Yeah, so this is definitely happening to New Zealand websites. And, you know, from our perspective, like, what do we do about it? So there's kind of two parts to this. There's what do we do about it as owners of websites and servers that are on the internet, and what do we do about it with all our inept users on our own corporate LANs that are going to be, you know, plugging their laptops, or not plugging them in, but connecting to techhead Wi-Fi and browsing insecurely or whatever they do. So from the web server point of view, basically all you can do is really patch. You know, we have to say that every time. Make sure you don't have crappy vulnerable code, which is really about testing, and having clued up developers. And then make sure that you update your components. So something that people find really hard is keeping all the other stuff that their applications depend on up to date. So, you know, you've got a user interface libraries or third-party components for doing AJAX or PDF creation or whatever, and you need to keep those up to date as well. And any one of those could have issues. Like, one of them was a CK editor, which is, you know, a little HTML editor. By default, it has an upload page. You know, if you just copy that onto your server, you get that. You probably want to keep reading the advisories for all these little things and make sure that you don't have issues that you don't know about.
So in essence, what you get by saving and using third-party components inside your apps, you do have to have, it doesn't come for free, so you don't just pay a license fee and install it. There is an overhead to keep looking at the security advisories for all the components and stuff that you are embedding in your systems all the time.
Yeah, and the other thing is, from the user point of view, so that's the really hard bit. So I think a really high percentage of these issues have been caused by Java, and Java's a cool enough programming language. Java's fine.
It was enthusiasm.
Java's fine on the server side, but I think we can all agree that applets never really took off. And every time someone installs Java on their desktop, it installs applet plugins in every browser, which is just rubbish. So we need to disable all those from our users. They don't need applets ability in any of their browsers, and if they do, almost certainly they'll be vulnerable right now or within the next couple of weeks. It's that regular. And the other thing we have to figure out is, how do we patch Adobe Reader? How do we patch Flash? How do we keep Silverlight up to date? All the things that run in the user's browser for our desktop, these kind of standard desktop issues. And then, with the whole bring your own desktop craze, how do we make sure people's personal laptops that they connect to the corporate environment or do business stuff on are safe? That's a really hard problem.
Absolutely. BYOD is it's great, it's cheap, but you now have unmanaged devices roaming around crazily around your network. So, okay. So one of the bits that we haven't, or to move on to, is kind of very chained and targeted attacks.
I wanted to tell a story here, and I wanted to get it right, so I wrote it down.
Once upon a time.
This is Matt.
Is Matt here?
No, Matt's not here.
No.
Matt's a journalist for The Wired magazine, and he had a very sad day a month ago. So he's a writer for The Wired magazine. He's a tweeter. He's got a three-letter Twitter account, M-A-T, which is kind of cool. Mine's got five letters, not as cool. At 5 o'clock on this Friday, he was playing with his kids and his iPhone turned off. He thought, well, that's weird. So he turned it back on, and it had been factory reset. And he thought, that's strange. So he entered his iCloud credentials into it. So Apple has a service where they'll restore your phone over the net. And it wouldn't accept his password. So he turned on his Mac, and his Mac warned him that his Gmail account password was wrong. He thought, that's a bit weird as well. Something screwy's going on. And then his Mac got bricked. So, remote wiped his Mac. So he unplugged his internet connection and ran to his wife's phone and called Apple. So he's trusted Apple to do his backups. So the other people he calls when he has an issue. As you would. And it turns out that he wasn't the first person to call Apple that day. So when he called Apple just after 5 o'clock, it was about 30 minutes after someone else had already called Apple. And that person had pretended to be him and reset his me.com email account and been sent a temporary password by Apple. And then about 20 minutes later, they'd reset his Gmail account. So his Gmail account had his me.com as its backup account, so if you forget that one, it'll email a temporary password to his Apple one. And then 2 minutes past five, they reset his Twitter password, they wiped his iPhone, they remote wiped his MacBook while he was watching, pretty much, and they deleted his 6 years' worth of Gmail, and in the process deleted all the pictures of his baby. And it's really sad. And then they posted a funny tweet at 12 minutes past five. And then he looked forlornly up to the right in a sad kind of way at them hacking his Twitter. So what can we learn from this story? Well, obviously, we're not as cool as him. We're wearing less cool clothes, and our Twitter handles are longer. But he actually ended up getting in touch with the guy that did it. So the two people were Clan VV3 and Phobia, and he promised Phobia he wouldn't take them to court, and Phobia told him all about how it happened, and Matt's written it up. And we'll put the links up on our website afterwards if you want to read it. So what the attacker did was, they thought, hey, I'd like to do something fun on Twitter. Who's got a cool Twitter account with lots of followers? And this guy had one with three letters, had lots of followers. Let's pick him. But they went to his website, and they thought his Twitter account probably uses his email address to log in, you know, as the reset password on the Twitter account. And so they went to his website and found that his email address was a Gmail one. They went to the Gmail password reset page, typed his address in, and it said, oh, you can't reset this account. What does it say? Forgotten your password and don't know your answers to secret questions. We can email a temporary blah, blah, blah to this address. And it's m...n@me.com. So they haven't told the whole email address, but his name is Matt Hannon, and the number of stars is the same as Hanno. So
can I guess that?
The attacker can guess what his email address is.
These are smart guys.
And this guy, Phobia, had done this before to me.com accounts. And so he knew that if he rang up Apple, all he needed to do to reset this me.com account was the guy's billing address and the last four digits of his credit card. And so next step was to find those two things. So billing address was easy because Matt's got his own domain name, and when you do a whois, it shows his address. The last four digits of the credit card's a little bit harder, but Phobia knew that Amazon have this nice feature. And so they thought they'd try going after Amazon to get the last four digits of the credit card. So they called Amazon and said, "Hey, I'm Matt. I don't remember my username and password right now. Actually, you're not even asking for it. I've got a new credit card to add to my account. Can I give it to you over the phone?" And Amazon said, "Yeah, sure." So Phobia gave him a fake credit card number, and all he needed to prove who he was his name, knows that, email address, also knows that, and billing address. Oh, bingo. So all three things he needs to add the credit card to Amazon. Then he hangs up from Amazon and calls them back straight away and says, "I've forgotten my password. Can you send a reset?" So Amazon's not silly. They don't just send resets to anyone. You have to prove who you are with your name, your billing address, and your credit card number.
That's good. Yeah.
And since he had just entered the new credit card number in the previous phone call, he was able to get them to send in a reset to the attacker's email address, log into Amazon as Matt, go in and look at the history, and it showed the current credit card and the previous one, the last four digits, took that to Apple, got them to reset his me.com account, used that to reset the Gmail account, and then from the Gmail account, got onto his Twitter account, from me.com, deleted his iPhone and MacBook remotely, which he later apologized for. He said he felt bad about that. But
also, he's got a conscience.
He sounds like a nice enough hacker.
Yeah.
But the story here, it isn't just a tale of woe over lost baby photos, although...
That's a woeful face.
That is a very woeful face. It's really about these chained attacks. So how many people have personal email accounts in your organization? I'm hoping that everyone does, or they're probably not in the technology industry. But everyone has personal email accounts. Everyone has work email accounts. Do they have the same passwords? Is it possible to reset one by knowing the email address of the other one? Last year there was a high-profile attack where someone got socially engineered into sending a root password to a guy's personal account. So that kind of, that chaining attack. So a determined person that wants to send a funny tweet on a three-character Twitter account, they will do six things in a row if that's what it takes to do that. And these weren't six particularly sophisticated things. All they needed to do was ring some phone numbers.
Well, let's face it, the security involved, so if you're Amazon, the security involved in the checks that you do for somebody to update their credit card details was like, well, that's how we get your money. So if anyone wants to update any bank details, credit card details to get money, yeah, that's no problem. That's fine. And so I guess that's also where things are failing, is that sometimes to update information into a system, well, that doesn't seem as though you're not getting anything bad out of us at the moment. But again, that was then what was being used to then extract the information.
Yeah, and the kind of sad thing there was that Apple were using as a secret the thing that Amazon didn't treat as a secret.
Absolutely.
Which was the four letters of the credit card. And I mean, anyone that knows anything to do with credit cards knows that it's the whole thing's a farce anyway. Your credit card number's not a secret. Like the kid that took the order over the phone when you ordered pizzas could have done the same thing to you and remote wiped your iPhone. There's nothing really protecting you. So it's just kind of an industry-wide issue to think about.
So it brings us on quite nicely to one of the other things that we've seen quite a lot of, particularly recently, which is passwords out in the wild. So there seems to have been a real rush recently of people getting their password databases hacked, looked over, extracted. And again, following, I guess, like the WikiLeaks ethos, instead of just stealing password databases and doing something private with it, why not put them online to kind of highlight how bad people have been? So there's been quite a few recently, but two of the biggest ones that worth mentioning are, in fact, the LinkedIn and the Yahoo Voices ones. So these were from, in July. Yahoo Voices, that was quite interesting, where it was, in fact, a SQL injection attack that got into the database. Now, just out of interest, I don't know if anyone remembers a presentation that we did back in 2009, when we were arming and ahhing and saying,
who was it then?
Do we talk about SQL injection? Because like, we actually apologized and we said, look, guys, we're going to show you some SQL injection, but it's like, it's old school.
I tried to talk Andy out of doing SQL injection because I thought that everybody knew about it.
So here we are, 2012, Yahoo Voices. SQL injection attack sucks all of the passwords out of the database. 453,000 passwords extracted. And when you looked at the dumps, it was the exact passwords of all of them. And if you look at the way that you could possibly store passwords, you know what? I'm actually going to set a challenge to the audience. We actually got a few prizes. this prize, actually, this is quite an impressive prize. This is pretty much a $100,000 prize. In fact, this is like $1 million prize, right? In the making. It's actually a $5 bonus paycheck for the casino down around the corner. But it's got the potential.
It's a token.
If anyone's feeling like a bit Michael Phelpsy, then and to walk out with $100,000, then what we'll do is just sign the back and we'll go like 50% goes back to Andy and Kirk. But for a $5 token, who thinks a great way that Yahoo Voices were storing their passwords? Yeah. Any takers?
How do you think they did?
Shout out. Plain text, who said that?
I hear it over here.
Dude, $5 casino token is yours. And if that comes to a six-figure number, then we definitely want half the returns.
I mean, if these guys read all the junk in the ticket bags, they're going to be on to us.
Really? Why?
Oh, no reason. Okay.
Oh, crap.
So, Yahoo Voice or Voices is actually 402 products, one called Yahoo Voice and one called Yahoo Voices. Voices.yahoo.com and voice.yahoo.com, and they're different. And the news articles around this interchangeably used one or the other. But I think it was Voices that had this issue.
Like it was.
Just storing passwords in plain text, plain database. Put up your hand if you've done that before. I've done that before. No one else putting their hand up.
Yeah, no, they're...
it's a stupid thing to do, but people do it.
LinkedIn weren't that dumb. So they had 6.5 million passwords stolen in June. Now, they weren't dumb. They didn't store them in plain text. They had hashed the passwords using SHA-1. So hashing with SHA-1 is good. Who won one? Okay, who was the first one who said salty? See, we've got one of these little gift things. Yeah, Delilah. For a $10 flute of champagne... Oh, dude, no, you don't drink champagne.
Andy will buy you the champagne. Yeah, how about
$5 that? Absolute vodka. Valid till, no, it hasn't expired. It's even real. Velcro champagne.
MacBook Pro.
Oh, will you get, no, paper off, that's fine. No. No, no. All right. three children and a...
I said I have nothing of value.
No children. Okay.
Cool.
So actually, Chris, so LinkedIn, so all they're doing, they are storing 6.5 million passwords as unsalted SHA-1 hashes. So what happens? So they are again extracted through SQL injection. Oh, before that was dead in 2009. So SQL injection, suck all the passwords out, SHA-1, and therefore they used a rainbow table attack. So with a rainbow table attack, of course, we just take dictionaries of as many words as we can come up with, and the fact here is that if you've used a good, strong password, then if it's just a single SHA-1 hash, you still won't break in. If you've got a 32-character, uppercase, lowercase, random characters with special characters, breaking that as a SHA-1 is still going to be really, really, really hard. It's only if you've got dumb, stupid passwords. But then some of the...
Who's going to use a complicated password on LinkedIn, right? Like, well, that's not really particularly high value. Well, not to me, I don't use it. But some of the stats, if you're looking for a job, maybe it's good.
It would be, but some of the stats of some of the passwords... LinkedIn, password, love, I love you, 1234.
Yeah,
these are some of the passwords actually extracted from LinkedIn.
So out of those 6.5 million passwords, 4,369 people had the password LinkedIn as their password.
Whoops.
Which is, I mean, it's not a huge ratio, but it's noticeable, right? And there's also more than half that number had I love you as their password, which, aww. I mean, I never felt that way about LinkedIn when I used it.
It's obviously the friends.
And people did some analysis of the passwords. So this has really been the year of password breaches. And have found that lots of people use the color of the website in the password, like whether it's a subconscious thing or not. So lots of the LinkedIn passwords had the word blue in them or blue things in them. And the other thing is that people use the same passwords everywhere. So when, was it the LinkedIn breach? I think it was the LinkedIn breach, where some other notable web properties like Twitter actually disabled the accounts of their users that had been in the LinkedIn breach. So proactively stopped attackers from logging into Twitter with the credentials that were stolen from LinkedIn.
Correct, because it is very common that once these password databases have been stolen and are in the wild, then what there's tools to do it is that basically they use those databases of passwords, usernames and passwords, and then try a plethora of Gmails, the LinkedIns, the Twitters. And so, again, this is where, and there's been a number of studies done, that people use anywhere on average between 3 and 5 passwords. So one will tend to be their internet banking, one will tend to be their work password, and then often there is just one other password that's just used globally for all other internet-y things. Some people get a little more hardcore. So I guess some of the issues that we do have to compromise or worry about all the way through is that users will do the least possible security practices they would get away with.
Yeah, and while I haven't seen any dumps of New Zealand passwords, I've definitely seen New Zealand usernames and online dumps. I think the Stratfor one had some New Zealand gov users in it. And so it's definitely something that's happening, and I've definitely seen New Zealand websites that have SQL injection. So it is just kind of a matter of time. What can we do about it? Well, there's the obvious thing of storing the passwords in a secure way as possible. But basically, if someone's got all those hashes from your passwords, even if you've hashed it with a salt, and they wanted to just get into Andy's account, they could still apply a lot of energy and effort into trying to guess the password that makes that hash.
Correct. Yep.
So if they've got motive and they want to get into it. So really, it's our job to protect the users of our systems from their other systems being attacked. Like just because I run some kind of daily deal website or something, some kind of small website has a few thousand New Zealanders in it, people are probably using the same password on that they're using on TradeMe. And so I need to keep my database safe because people's TradeMe credits could be abused. Well, you know, that sort of thing. Possibly they use the same one as their internet banking. You know, so it's our responsibility. So what can we do? Well, application level stuff, like obviously you shouldn't write shitty applications, but that's kind of a hard thing. Storing your passwords, maybe segmenting your authentication system from the rest of your database. So chances are there's probably only 1 or 2 pages in your application that actually need to connect to the user table and verify a password. Maybe make it so the rest of the app can't talk to that table. So if you've got SQL injection somewhere else, that they can't traverse that and get to the user table, maybe even store the user stuff on a different machine behind a web service. You know, there's 1,001 different ways of doing it, but just think about how do you segment your data. And things like PCI force you to do this with credit cards if you're unlucky enough to store credit card numbers.
So yes, so the fact is that we often know how to defend against these things, but it does happen. So only last week, there was another sort of more localized security breach. I don't know if anyone here kind of read or noticed about it when you checked your email last Thursday morning. So there was a conference running, and for this particular conference last Thursday morning, out came some emails that said, oh, by the way, click this email and we'll generate you a barcode so that when you arrive at a conference, we can fast track you in. So, for instance,
someone wants to stand in queues at ticket, right?
No, that's right. And so.
They all knew it.
I know they did. So the fact is, I'm sitting there. So Fluffy Duck is the password that I use across all of my things, including internet banking, because it just makes it easier that way. So I'm looking at this link, and I'm going, well, what the crap is my password on the end of this link? How the buggery does that work?
And there's also some other security stuff there, like Fast Track and 673.
Yes, good point. 673, of course, being the ID of the conference.
Cool, so fair enough. It's the same for everyone.
So I don't know how many people saw this, but if you look at this, so this is an interesting thing. You think, well, hang on a mo, we logged on to the TechEd website a couple of weeks ago and put in our username and password, and now a few weeks later, we're getting an email with our password in the URL and an email for me to fast track register. Well, doesn't this, obviously, and again, the Microsofties also themselves saw this. Because, of course, it's not from Microsoft, it's from the vendor they have, who then use another vendor to actually write the software. Yeah. So when you saw this, a couple of major fails. It's like, well, so obviously plain text password.
Yeah, so they must be storing up plain text, because otherwise they couldn't have emailed it to us. So that's bad. They sent it over email, which is unencrypted, went through a bunch of mail servers on the way. That's bad. They had a direct reference to the conference ID, so that's we'll get to that, and the password on the end of the URL. So what you could do is just change the end of the URL to passwords that people would probably like to use. So I tried password, and someone's ticket registration and their name came up. And I tried ticket and someone else's came up. And I tried ticket 12 and someone else's came up.
So that's right. So they were actually using the password as the key to look up the user. That's a unique design principle.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is an example of how the most secure company in the world can still make security mistakes. Like, I think Microsoft do an amazing job of security and they probably spend more on it than any other software company. But when they run a conference, they outsource the running of the conference and that person outsources it. And it's impossible to read the code of everyone that contributes to your whole ecosystem, right? How many of you have read the JavaScript to Gmail? The PDF component you use, or, it's just impossible to do. What was good is how quickly they fixed this issue.
Absolutely.
So I think between when it was on Twitter and we emailed them to when it was fixed was a few hours. They took the page offline first and then they rewrote the functionality. So it was a pretty admirable, fast response.
It was. And we haven't verified this one, but at least Owen Wallace did reckon that they printed the password on the back of your password, Australian ticket. I haven't verified that, but at least that makes one not quite so bad.
Yeah.
So we're over time, so we're just going to finish with our last summary slide. What is it we have covered in our From the Trenches today? So you absolutely want to be thinking about motive and opportunity, but like with Language Perfect, you're not going to work out the motive if people are going to target you. It's just going to happen. So what you absolutely should be doing is, from a denial of service, keeping your systems running, always think and pre-plan who you're going to call, run these fire drills to work out, if you've got the SLAs with the people who write the code, is it your code? What components do you use?
Yeah, I think pretending that they're not going to have the motive to attack you, that doesn't really work. So you have to assume that people are going to attack you. It's going to be opportunistic or maybe targeted. You've got to make sure you patch all your frameworks, have a process for making sure patching happens over the holidays, have a process for patching old software that no one cares about. Make sure your code is secure. So we've had some training sessions before where we've gone over secure development, got an architecture session tomorrow looking at the life cycle of apps, and a mobile one on Friday. So come along to those. Scan your systems regularly. So this is kind of hard to do. Like, some of these things you won't notice when you access the site as you. So there's security scanning software, like Aura's got some that will scan your web servers. There's other stuff that will detect files that have changed on disk. So you'll see if someone's tampered with your code. Run that kind of software. From a user point of view, we have to try and teach our users to use unique secure passwords. Unfortunately, they don't.
But it won't happen.
So we have to assume that they're not.
Yep.
So they'll be doing anything they can to be insecure. And then I guess the last thing is, have that plan for when you get attacked. So we've talked about some people that got it right and some people that got it wrong. I think the thing that makes you come out of this happy at the end of it is having a plan, knowing who to call. So companies like F5 that sell those WAF devices, they have the ability to come in super fast and plonk one of them in your network. So maybe get in touch with someone like that in advance. Say, we can't afford it right now. We want to, I don't know if you have to pay kind of an upfront just in case fee, or I don't know how it works. But just start having those discussions about how you can plan for attack.
Cool.
Cool. And last thing is, we'll stick our slides up at hack-ed.com. And they'll also be on the TechEd slide.
Correct.
Our site. You can email us if you've got questions or hang around afterwards.
Yep, we'll be here for questions. And of course, we have
don't forget your prizes. Lucky
$500,000 prize. That's amazing. You've just got to do the other $499,995 worth of work. Cool. So awesome. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you for coming. Hopefully, we'll see you tomorrow.